and welcome to Album, the David Bowie podcasts in which I ramble incoherently for ages with an erudite, witty and articulate guest about a David Bowie album of their choice. And this week, I am extraordinarily pleased to have with me the Emmy Award-winning writer, critic and broadcaster, David Quantick. David's colourful career ranges from music criticism for Q, The Word and the late lamented NME, amongst others, to picking up an Emmy Award for his writing for the Armando Iannucci satire Veep. He's also a professional grumpy old man, and he writes comedy gold for the likes of Rob Brydon, Michelin Webb, Harry Hill, Collins and McConey. Well, it goes on and on and on, and instead of me reading you his Wikipedia entry, you can read it yourself, or better still, just check out some of his work. I guarantee you will like it. I was surprised to discover that not only would David Quantick agree to do me the honour of appearing on this podcast discussing two albums, the other will be out in a couple of weeks, but that this longtime Bowie aficionado, the man whose crisp, barbed prose spiked the NME of the 1980s like a crotchety cross between Lester Bangs and P.G. Woodhouse, this word voila extraordinaire chose the insipid 1999 album Hours as his nominated long player. Now, this was a poser. When Hours came out, I was rather caught up in the throes of Britpop and late 90s hipster indie ear candy and that sort of thing. At the time, I thought Bowie rather passé and clunky, to be honest. I did belong to the fledgling BowieNet site, though, and I enjoyed his back catalogue as much as ever. It was really the long-haired, designer-stubbled, clearly happy, content and genial Dave who appeared on the Michael Parkinson show, or on Top of the Pops, warbling some guff about Thursday's Child that slightly affronted me. To me, it sounded a bit like a bad Sting, or the Lighthouse Family, you know, music for Mondeo men living in Telford. It was M.O.R., it was dull, and it was further blunted by the dreary presence of Reeves Gabrels on guitar and on co-songwriting duties. But David Quantick had asked for Hours, and so Hours it was. And I began listening to it and reading up on it. And you know what? In its dullness, it sort of started becoming interesting. Here's something that helped me get a bit of a handle on it. This is what Bowie himself had to say about it at the time of its release in 1999. I wanted to capture a kind of universal angst felt by many people my age. You could say that I'm attempting to write some songs for my generation. Aha! So, it was an album by and for middle-aged people. You see, then I wasn't middle-aged, but now I am. So with this in mind, I revisited Hours, and what do you know, I liked it. Well, in parts I liked it. It still feels like a pair of aged slippers, comfy, dull and functional. The production is a bit ropey. I mean, come on, what's missing here is Tony Visconti. And it's lackluster and quite wishy-washy to my ears. That said, I do like Survive, What's Really Happening, Seven, Thursday's Child. They're all pleasant tunes. They possess a few sparkly moments of fleeting Bowie magic. But the more rocky numbers, well, again, to me, it's so much Tin Machine. Ponytailed, deadpan, bald guys with weirdly shaped guitars self-consciously freaking out. It just doesn't do it for me. But then, you know, Hours grew out of sessions for Bowie's video game, Omicron, The Nomad Soul, which is quite funny if you get the chance to experience it. And also, Hours holds the accolade of being the first ever album by a major artist to be available for download weeks before its physical release. Another early example of David Bowie breaking the internet there, and something else that's quite intriguing, that this is a very futuristic album in many ways, despite being very retro in form and in content. Apparently Bowie had been listening to a lot of his old stuff online, and that had informed a lot of the songwriting here. But one last thing, in a funny synchronicity, David Quantick is also partly responsible for an internet first, the world's first internet-only sitcom, written with Jane Busman in 2000, the year after Hours, which was a sort of situ documentary, as he put it. But yeah, so both Quantick and Bowie doing internet firsts around that time. So now let's crack on with the show, and I will take you straight to the heart of the cut and thrust of our conversation, and I'm going to drop you in at the point where I've just asked David Quantick a fiendish question. David, why Hours?
It's really simple. Hours was the moment, 1999, when I got asked by Q magazine if I wanted to interview David Bowie, and of course I said yes. So, you know, at the time, I'd rather obviously it had been Heroes or Ziggy Stardust or something like that. But Hours, because of that, is a really important milestone in my relationship with David Bowie's career. I got flown to New York. I met a friend of mine who was working in the Virgin press office in New York. It was, you know, you couldn't ask for anything better. And it was one of the best experiences of my life interviewing him. And the album had very, very little to do with it.
So what was he like then?
It was brilliant. I went into Virgin and it was one of those cool New York sunny offices. And there was somebody in from a European magazine doing a quick interview. Then I went in because I was from Q magazine. Obviously, he had more time for me because he knew that Q would do a nice job, do a proper interview, would know what they're talking about, and, you know, put him on the cover or something. And he was amazing. He had his strange, wispy long hair at this point. He looked great. I would definitely have had sex with him had he asked. And it was such a fun interview. I've said this before, but it was such a fun interview that afterwards my mouth hurt because I'd been smiling. I'd been grinning. Yeah. I don't like smiling. I'd been grinning for an hour. He was great. He did what you wanted. He talked about anything, and he didn't really want to talk about Hours, which is something
really?
We can. Yeah, I mean, the reason for this, I think, is because Hours is basically the soundtrack for a computer game called Omicron Soul, I believe, and everything came out of that. So it's only incidentally an album. Its origins are as a game soundtrack.
Oh, I see. Right.
And it grew organically out of that. Because he'd said that he didn't want to do the classic kind of Nine Inch Nails style industrial grungy soundtrack. He wanted to make an album of songs to go with the game. And of course it works very well.
Right.
But we can talk about that in a minute. So he didn't really want to talk about it. When I mentioned it, a couple of times he'd brush it off, you know, almost on the lines of, oh, we don't need to talk about that.
Normally when you do these sorts of interviews, you've got a PR standing there making sure that you don't ask anything that's off topic. And in this case, it sounds like that really wasn't the case.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously David Bowie knows what he's doing. And there was, sadly, an interview structure that other journalists have mentioned, that you go in, he says, hi, I'm David. And of course, if you're a fan, you get really excited. And sadly, I didn't get to say, so am I, because that would have been stupid. And it's interesting, he gets irritated at one point, which is generally, if you ask a question that's not in his head, he looks a bit vexed, and he did this in a lot of interviews. So if I brought up the album, he'd get a bit annoyed. He just wanted to tell stories. So I mentioned something. He said, oh, I remember being in the Hollywood Hills, you know, buying drugs, and Sly Stone was there, and he looked at me in my preppy gear. He's like, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? You shouldn't be here. Look at you. And I'd done my research, and there was just enough internet in 1999 to do online research. And I found his website, which had just gone up. And that greatly pleased him, because I think my opening question was, what have you got against Croydon? Because in the website, he went on about Croydon and how much he hated it, because in the 60s, he'd worked in ad agencies and Croydon was just kind of a hell of the soul to him. It was the opposite of trendy London, I think. So he was, and he obviously just thought, great, it's Q magazine, they think they're funny, so it's going to be one of those interviews, and went on about Croydon and Sly Stone, and was just lots and lots of fun and really engaging. And I remember saying, you know, oh, you're the only person who's worked with Lulu and, you know, Lou Reed, Lulu and Bing Crosby. And he did this great story about meeting Bing Crosby to do Little Drummer Boy. See, nothing to do with Iris, any of this. I said, you know, I went in and he looked like a little wrinkled orange. So it was an extraordinary interview. It was loads. And then it ended, apparently all Bowie interviews end like this. Finished, and it's like, PR, we've got to go now. And he always does a bit at the end. So he sat on the sofa and he told me how Mike Garson from his band had been approached by a mysterious other band to be keyboard player, and he was going, and it turned out to be Marilyn Manson, which Bowie found hilarious that Marilyn Manson was trying to recruit his band. And then he told another story, because we're in New York, our Bleecker Bob's record shop, this famous secondhand record shop, Bleecker Bob, a famous over-the-top loud character. He said, oh yeah, Bob, every time I go into a shop he puts on the Laughing Gnome. And it was a brilliant story to tell. The Laughing Gnome, by the way, brings me to my next thing, which is other times I have met David Bowie that I know you want me to.
What times?
I have met him three times. That once was that interview. Another time, I'd been to see the brilliant Low Heathen gig at the Royal Festival Hall when he did both albums with my first wife. And I was introduced to him, and I could see his eyes glazing over because I'd had a drink and I wanted to talk about the track listing, which is obviously he was well up for, not. He was more interested in looking at my wife. But the other occasion, he was doing a Greatest Hits tour, the Sound and Vision tour, I think the end of the 80s, early 90s, where basically you would phone up and he would count the votes and play songs. It was a bizarre request tour. And I went to the press conference at the Rainbow, and he was on stage with an acoustic guitar. We were all down in the pit, as it were. I remember putting my hand up saying, David Quantick NME, if you got enough votes, would you do the Laughing Gnome? And literally, he put his hands on the guitar and went, I was walking down the high street when I heard foot. So I lay claim to being the only person who's got David Bowie to play the Laughing Gnome live. I mean, probably literally the only time he's played it live. I'm still proud, though, we came up with a great headline, which was basically asking people if they'd like to hear Heroes or the Laughing Gnome, and the headline was No More Heroes.
So let's look at ours. Very straightforward. There are very normal songs on here. There's lots of guitars. There are some fairly introspective singer-songwriter lyrics. Ours isn't really one of my favourite albums.
It's an indication of how we see David Bowie's music. He releases an album full of tunes and choruses, and everyone goes, what's the hell's that? It's an underrated album, but not that much underrated. When I first heard it, I was quite disappointed because it was so soft. I think it was underproduced. It's interesting because they got Marius de Vries to get him to do all these remixes. Obviously, that means that somebody, probably at the record company, wasn't very happy.
Yeah, because there are tons and tons of different versions, remixes.
Yeah, there isn't another David Bowie album with so many reworkings and redoings. Extra choruses and bits of guitars and hooks, but unlike most things done around that time when it was to, you know, get a single into the charts and have a dance mix by the Chemical Brothers or whatever, some of the tracks that have come out since were on The Game, were on Nomad Soul, so they were part of The Game, so they would be different mixes for that. Some of them are demos, and some of them were mixes by Marius de Vries for singles. And I think, A, they're kind of fun because they're different enough to be worth hearing, but B, it's an indication of where Bowie was at the time. He's made this Game soundtrack that is no... that they're good songs, but they're not obvious singles.
Right.
You know, it's hard to explain. They're not pop hits. You couldn't imagine someone else covering one of them. But they are good. I mean, Thursday's Child, that could have been an album track for somebody else. But it's a strange mixture, and you can imagine the record company being a bit frustrated by this. Virgin, it was at the time.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do that well. It's the first one to not make the top 50 in America since Ziggy Stardust came out. And he takes time off after that, I think. It is a lovely album. And when he did finally get round to mentioning Hours to me in passing, he said it wasn't a personal record at all. It wasn't about him. It was David Bowie meditating on the idea of a man in his 50s. He was in his 50s at the time. But someone else in their 50s. But I don't agree with that. My theory is that he's writing about someone else yet again, but this time it's not Aladdin Sane or the Thin White Duke.
Yeah, it's none of those characters. It's him. It's him as a middle-aged man, which must be sort of equally freaky.
It's a normal person, but the normal person is actually a character who's him. It's a bit complicated, a bit possibly inaccurate. And he did get ratty at one point in the interview because I pointed out that the lyrics of one song mention his brother and his mother, and he's saying, well, that's nothing to do with me, that's just a coincidence. And I don't think it is just a coincidence. He's a middle-aged man singing about a middle-aged man. He's thinking about getting older, about relationships. And also, it's a really lyrical album. It's really melodic and lovely. Seven, Thursday's Child, Survive. They're lovely tunes. They're really understated and they're really gentle. They slide away. In some ways, it's a bit like, a bit like Hunky Dory. It even has the rockers on it, like Hunky Dory does, like The Pretty Things Are Going to Hell and What's Really Happening. We have to point out, of course, What's Really Happening was written by a competition winner, Alex Grant, who got to go to New York with his mate, meet David Bowie, and there's a downside to everything. Won a 3-year subscription to Rolling Stone.
Yeah, well, I've actually got a little clip here of the moment where Alex was handed his publishing check, and he got to meet David Bowie.
Hello.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
Hello, collaborator. Hi.
Hello.
Good to see you. This is Reeves Cabrales. Reeves,
hello.
Alex.
Hi. Congratulations.
Well done. You. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really cool. You had a nice weekend?
Yeah, wonderful.
Here we are, foursome. Great. Really nice to meet you. Well
nice
done.
Meeting
That's
you.
A good song.
Thank you.
Never try and sing them.
I think about it now, it is let down by the production. Production is a bit thin, but there's a lot of really good stuff on it, and I really like it as Bowie's middle-aged album. It works really well in that context.
It's interesting that it comes at this point in his career. It comes after the sort of weirdness of Earthling being a kind of pop weird album, after the very difficult Outside, which of course ironically has a hit with the Pet Shop Boys. People still hadn't quite forgiven David Bowie for the 80s and then for Tin Machine, but it, you know, Tin Machine, as people say, was a sorbet to clear the palate. It was very much a way to get rid of the 80s pop detritus. And then he had to get rid of Tin Machine. So there's more to come. And the thing that's more to come is...
Heathen is, I mean, I've never read anything by Adorno, that's my introduction, but there is this whole thing of late maturity in art that, you know, people start off writing really nice pieces for light instruments like flutes and violins, and by the end they're writing for cellos and they're really dark. It's sort of mahogany versus balsa wood. And Heathen is definitely late maturity. It's interesting when he goes back to it on Black Star, there are different reasons, but Heathen is like, I'm getting older. And I think that Hours is an attempt, a tentative attempt to do that. The title, the sleeve image of an older Bowie holding a younger Bowie, though you have to read about that to discover they're meant to be different ages because they look the same. And I think Hours is a sketchy album. That's my definition.
What's going on here with the production? So we've got Marius de Vries.
Marius. Bizarrely, I lived upstairs to him for a few years, which is a bit. A flat in Hanway Place off Hanway Street. I had a flat in a side street off an alleyway off Tottenham Court Road. It's actually in a Neil Gaiman novel, I think Neverwhere, as a mystical gate. It was great. And Marius lived downstairs.
Yeah, that's where they've got all those drinking clubs.
Yeah, it's where all the Spanish drinking clubs were, and Troy. And it was a great place to live. So we had Marius in the basement. We had an escort agency between, well, the flat of some people who ran an escort agency between us who got into trouble with a Tory peer who was one of their clients. It was very exciting. That was the time that I went to see Bowie, and it was, yeah. Marius did tell me once that Stephen Fry spoke to him in Dutch, and he just said, what? Which was great, Stephen Fry showing off. But yeah, Marius is a really nice man, really good producer. Obviously been called in to steroid things up a bit. And yeah, so Hours is sketchy. It's kind of not, it's like three quarters formed all the way through. And you can tell that Bowie likes it, because while he didn't want to talk about it, when he did the BBC live show, and also when he did the reality tour, he did a lot of songs from it. Proportionally, there's quite a few. There's more songs from that than some other albums. So he clearly liked the songs.
Yeah. If you had to sit back and survey it as a whole, what are your standout tracks then? Can you tell us a bit about those?
I mean, I love Seven. It's got a beautiful tune. Seven and Thursday's Child, to me, are companion pieces. They go together. They're beautiful lyrics, really nice tunes. I like the joke of, you know, the pretty things are going to hell, because that is a Bowie in joke. It's like Iggy Pop, your pretty face is going to hell, combined with, here's a tie-in, the pretty things will turn up in pin-ups later on. So it's kind of again, I mentioned it and he did that irritated face.
You said in your interview with him that you told him, well, this album is basically your CV.
Yeah, I think that rings a bell. Yeah, and he was like, well, it's self-explanatory. It's interesting, some albums he wanted to talk about, not to me, but I've read interviews, some albums he wants to talk about in detail, some albums he doesn't. He just didn't want to talk about this one much. So maybe because it was personal, who knows? I don't like speculating, but I am going with the theory that it was more personal than he claimed.
Yeah, I do get the feeling, I mean, especially talking to you, that it was an album that had a very deep resonance with him and very much born of his experiences at the time.
Yeah, and maybe disguising them in this way, saying they're a... Instead of saying, you know, the Thin White Duke or Ziggy Stardust, saying it's a middle-aged man whose life's gone wrong, which obviously wasn't his life. You know, his life was on the up at this point. Right. But, yeah, when you think of the emotional songs, you mention Word on a Wing. That's, about his relationship with God. There are very few straightforward... Kooks is a rare one. Everyone Says Hi on Heathen, which I'm convinced is a sequel to Kooks. That's my theory. No one else...
About Duncan.
Yeah, it's...
Or directed to Duncan.
I think it's about... want a child leaving home.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it is, you know.
Songs like Something in the Air, for example, are intensely personal songs. They're very naked. I mean, he hasn't been writing these sorts of lyrics since songs like Letter to Hermione on Space Odyssey. So in this album, things are potentially bleak and inward-looking. But then in his personal life, he's in a pretty good place at this point, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's about 52 at this point, 52, 53. He's done the big Madison Square Gardens concert, which is one of the...
Oh, the 50th birthday.
Yeah, which is an amazing thing. It's a hard listen, but it's like everybody from Smashing Pumpkins to The Cure, Lou Reed, they're all there. So he's done this look back on his career. He does that great quote at the end, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I promise you it won't be boring. And Earthling, you know, underrated record. He's in a good place. He's got the 80s behind him.
What do you think of Earthling? I mean, do you think that album really hangs together?
I don't know if it hangs together. I just really like it. I love Little Wonder. It is a bit chaotic in production styles. And he did a lot of gigs around that time. I went to the Hanover Grand one.
Right.
So it was strange. The drum and bass thing gets mocked a lot, but why not? You know, everyone was doing it. Pet Shop Boys were doing it. It was an exciting new music. Unfortunately, it was an exciting new music that didn't go anywhere. You know, so there's no son of drum and bass. It was just a brief period in popular music history, so it sounds terribly dated now. But Little Wonder's a great song. And also he's comfortable enough, this is one of my favourite themes, with his past, that in the 90s he starts back referring. So the Buddha of Suburbia is full of, you know, it's got Space Oddity, it's got... Little Wonder is a Bowie pastiche. It's like, he's heard Suede. He thought, and every time Bowie gets ripped off, he goes, I'm having that. You know, every time someone rips off Bowie, he rips them off. So Little Wonder is a Suede song with drum and bass on it.
Yeah, he said in that interview with Brett Anderson in The NME around 93 that he'll just have anything, basically. If he hears someone ripping him off, he'll rip it off back.
He's not got any problems with pastiche and being ripped off. That, like on Let's Dance, he does modern, I've forgotten the name of it, Criminal World, which was, you know, by a band called Metro. And it was a Bowie sound-alike song, and he just thought, I'll have that back. And he was nice about Gary Newman in later life. You know, when Newman was big, he had him kicked out of a TV studio. Yeah.
But he heard he was there.
But then later on, he said loads of really nice things about him. So he was, you know, he was open. So he's comfortable with himself in the 90s.
Yeah, it's like on Black Tie White Noise, where he does a cover of Morrissey's I Know It's Going to Happen Someday, which is basically Morrissey pastiching Bowie. So Bowie kind of goes and picks that up again.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's probably the only album with a Cream cover and a Morrissey cover on it. Can't stand Morrissey's. I don't want to talk about that. But yeah, it's interesting. I forgot about Night Flights. Night Flights is good because it's a proper, respectful cover version that you wouldn't know it wasn't him, but also it sounds like the original. And the whole Scott Walker thing after, I mean, it was just Scott Walker mad. The last two albums he did...
Do you remember when it was Bowie's birthday and he was on the radio for something and they got Scott Walker to call up and wish him happy birthday? He was so thrilled.
Yeah, it was Marianne Hobbs.
Speechless, absolutely speechless.
Bowie is delighted. It's fascinating that, you know, obviously we know that Scott Walker was an influence and the Brell thing was very important, but that Bowie is delighted by this, you know, more than if Dylan had phoned up. So it's really nice, and also the fact that Scott Walker is delighted to return the favour.
Yeah.
Do you remember hearing about the legendary Stardust Cowboy and what a huge influence he was on Bowie? And the legendary Stardust Cowboy, or the Ledge, as everyone calls him, was complaining he wasn't really making very much money out of this constant name-dropping. And so then Bowie goes and records Gemini Spacecraft on Heathen. And then I think around that time they met backstage and... Bowie was incredibly excited to meet him and sort of rushed forward on being introduced, and the Ledge backed away, arms in the air going, no, whoa, you know, stand back, young man.
Also, as a nerd, I think the Gemini spaceship is on Mercury. I think they were actually on the same label.
Yeah, but I think they ditched the Ledge when Bowie was signed up in 72.
Not surprised. I saw the legendary Stardust Cowboy once. He was pretty good. God, that would be about 1980.
Right.
No, 1985, something like that. But yeah, you could do a great thing about Bowie's covers, Bowie's influence, also Bowie's anecdotes, because on the VH1 Storytellers thing, he tells these stories, and people have gone through them and gone, that would be quite difficult for that to have happened. And when I saw him do the Heathen thing, he played 515, The Angels Are Calling, and he tied it in with The Who's 515, and also the story of him and Pete Townsend going out on the lash, and it's like, yeah... That happened then, and so the Pete Townsend story is around the time of Who Are You, so it's late 70s, and Townsend is the one where he says in the story he's woken up by a policeman who says, if you can tell me your name, you can go home. Yeah. But 515 is from, you know, about 73 or so.
It's Quadrophenia, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but then, to be honest, if I'd taken the amount of drugs that he'd taken, I wouldn't be able to tell things apart anyway.
Well, something else that was... interesting about Hours, I thought, was the fact that he was online at this point. He was getting online, he'd set up BowieNet, And he'd spent a lot of time going over files of his own stuff. I mean, release stuff and bootlegs that he'd found floating around the internet. And, well, BowieNet. Do you remember BowieNet? I was on that. I was a member for a while. And Bowie himself would come on it poking around the message boards. And I think he called himself Sailor. Yeah, that was it.
Was it Sailor? I've seen in retrospect, his moments on Bowie. I forget what it was, sadly. A Bowie biography, a recent one. And it was pointing out how he'd sort of struggled, you know, he got wildly enthusiastic about things, but he couldn't control himself. You know, he'd get into something and then get something else by the time the album... And in the 70s, after Ziggy, he'd managed to get it so he could do one an album. So he'd do Ziggy and he kept it going for a few years, but then he got bored. And it's just fascinating that, you know, you invent something commercial and it's like, oh, I'm bored now. And you look at, as somebody said, you know, people have made whole careers out of one Bowie album. Whereas he's like, I've done that now, Plastic Soul, I'll get a big guitarist in or whatever.
So why do you think that he wasn't really working with Tony Visconti at this point? I mean, where was Visconti?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, we sort of, Visconti's now tied in with the Bowie legend, now that Bowie's gone. But they didn't always work together, you know, they didn't work together during the 80s at all. Visconti was doing a lot of pop stuff. He did Modern Romance, an awful lot of different people. So it's not that they fell out, it's just that they kind of, I don't know if they fell out or not, but they had parallel careers.
Just to wrap up, how do you summarise your feelings about Hours?
I think about it now, it is let down by the production. Production is a bit thin. But there's a lot of really good stuff on it, and I really like it as Bowie's middle-aged album. It works really well in that context. It's interesting that it comes at this point in his career. It comes after the sort of weirdness of Earthling being a kind of pop weird album after the very difficult Outside, which of course ironically has a hit with the Pet Shop Boys. People still hadn't quite forgiven David Bowie for the 80s and then for Tin Machine, but it, you know, Tin Machine, as people say, was a sorbet to clear the palate. It was very much a way to get rid of the 80s pop detritus. And then he had to get rid of Tin Machine. So there's more to come. And the thing that's more to come is Heathen. Yeah, Hours is a really interesting staging post. Not every album has to be Heroes or Sgt. Pepper or Beggar's Banquet. Hours is an underrated album and really worth listening to.
Well, I think that says it all. Thank you so much, David.
And there we are, and there we have it. That's David Quantick and myself sporadically talking about Hours for your thrills, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Friend Quantick returns soon for some straight talk about another significant Bowie album, and this one, I must say, is one I really do like. But for now, my thanks to my guest David Quantick. Thanks to Nadia Shireen for the use of her kitchen to record this in.
And thanks also to Charlotte Hatherley for this lovely music which she's let us use for the podcast, and it's called Lonely Waltz.
And thanks to you for listening to us and for supporting this podcast. If you're so minded, please do like and review this edition, and I'll be very grateful to you indeed. So, till next time then, it's cheerio from me, Arsene Mohammed. Take care, and I'll see you again soon.